This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Happy Halloween to all of you who celebrate. I am here in the Vermont Edition studio wearing a lackluster tiger costume surrounded by candy wrappers. That's no joke. I will share a photo on Instagram. Today, in honor of Halloween, we're going to explore some of the spookiest places that exist. Old graveyards. In a bit, Amanda Gustin will join us. She is the collections director at the Vermont Historical Society, and she has been collecting lots of facts for us about our region's strangest tombstones and scariest tales. But first, who here has seen the new Beetlejuice sequel? I love the original movie because it's one of those rare Halloween flicks that isn't actually scary or gory, but it'll still send a tingle up your spine. It's also inspired Halloween costumes for decades.
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
It's showtime.
Some of you might know that Beetlejuice has its roots in Vermont. Back in the 80s, director Tim Burton and his Hollywood crew came to the small Vermont village of East Corinth to make the film. Last year, they returned to Vermont to film the sequel, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, which came out this fall. Our producer, Daniela Fierro, headed to East Corinth to hear what it's like to see your village become a movie set again.
There's been a lot of movies set in Vermont, but most of the time, they're not actually filmed here. That's part because Vermont doesn't offer tax credits to filmmakers like some other states do. So when the Beetlejuice crew arrived in 1987, it was a big deal. Beetlejuice tells the story of a recently deceased couple played by Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin. They enlist the help of the mischievous Beetlejuice to scare away the Dietz family, who moved into their home. The film takes place in the fictional town of Winter River, Connecticut, but it was filmed in East Corinth, Vermont. For the sequel, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, the crew returned in 2023 to recreate the locations from the original film.
Anything that we saw or knew, we either had an NDA or an honest pinky swear. And I think some of the things they released were actually to throw people off. And they did.
Wade Pearson was born and raised in East Corinth. He calls himself a Beetlejuice enthusiast. Wade guides us through the village. We take a walk up the road until we reach a big white building. I recognize it from the first movie. It's Miss Shannon's School for Girls, where teenage Lydia Dietz, played by Winona Ryder, goes to school.
On my way down here, I was dropping off a couple pumpkins at Miss Shannon's, and a car was already there, and I couldn't help but they'd come so far. They said they were from Wisconsin.
Ryder reprises her role as Lydia in the sequel. The school is briefly seen in the second movie as her daughter, Astrid, played by Jenna Ortega, bikes through the village. The schoolhouse is over 100 years old, and it was recently sold. A sign in the building says they're hoping to restore the building and give it a new life. They would like to transform it into a Beetlejuice museum, community center, and theater, and they're looking for donations. Outside of the building is a sign that looks just like the one in the first movie.
And somewhere maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I made a big one to put up on Miss Shannon's school. It's a poster from the 87 VHS sleeve.
Yeah. Wade says he put up the photos around town that showcase locations from the film. It takes about 10 minutes to see all the spots featured in Beetlejuice. Wade points out all the small yellow cones with black stripes that dot the road. Wade calls them sandworms, like the striped snake worm monster in the movie. He says the cones mark key points of interest where parts of the village were featured in the original film.
Even before there was, word of a second one coming, I couldn't mow my lawn without people stopping me and asking directions or walk to the post office.
When the news of the sequel was announced, villagers were excited to see the crew return. Filming in Vermont began in the summer of 2023. Wade says there has been an influx of visitors. He estimates that during filming, they had up to 1,100 a day. If you're planning to visit, you should know that the set designers work some Hollywood magic. You won't be able to track down every building you see in the movie. The main house was just a facade. It was taken down after production wrapped. And the covered bridge in both movies was a set piece, too. While we're in the village, we meet Sarah Polly. She grew up in East Corinth. She invites us into her home.
Come on in.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
Danila and
Mike.
She's seen just about every Beetlejuice-related event you can imagine, right from her home.
I've seen everything. I've seen
engagement take place over on this bridge. I've seen people come dressed as Lydia. There was a young lady dressed as Lydia, and she was over on the bridge, and her boyfriend was taking her picture. Occasionally, you'll see somebody come dressed as Beetlejuice.
Sarah said she visited the set a lot during the first production.
I mean, that first movie, it might have been 15 or 20 people with Tim Burton, and I just remember a wagon with four wheels and a camera.
You can even see her home in the first movie, kind of.
It was the Winter River Fire Department, and they did put like a facade over my garage doors and painted the doors red, and they parked a big fire engine out here in the yard.
She shows us photos of actor Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin hanging out in her front lawn between takes.
Oh, this Gina and Alec. I got to meet her parents. Her parents used to come back every summer for a while and visit my uncle, I do believe.
She recalls Winona Ryder playing touch football across the street with locals. Her uncle was also in the film.
Well, my uncle, Morris Page, was in the film. And Tim Burton took a liking to him, and he was quite the Vermont character. When they tried to have him be the barber, he kept ad-libbing. And so they had to find a different position for him. So he ended up being Ernie, who was polishing the lions that were over on the steps to the library. And I think all he had to do was wave to Alec and Gina and go, "Hi, how are you?"
Sarah says she's spoken to people from all over the world who have come to the village to see a slice of film history.
I've had tourists from Belgium, Germany, Spain, France, Great Britain, Canada, and all over the United States.
We notice this too. We meet a woman from Florida and a group of people visiting from Spain.
Are you guys here to see the Beetlejuice?
From Spain.
From Spain. Hola, soy Daniela.
Hola,
soy productora.
Hola, hola.
Soy productora de...
They're traveling all over New England. I asked them why they decided to make a stop in the village.
Yo por lo menos soy muy friki de Tim Burton y me gusta el tema de Beetlejuice.
They're big fans of Tim Burton and they love Beetlejuice. They've seen both movies and they said they wanted to visit the village where the movie was filmed.
Hemos visto las dos películas y bueno...
Back at Sarah's home, she shares one last fond memory of talking to Tim Burton during last year's production.
Well, I did get to speak to Tim Burton and told him I remembered him from 36 years ago. And I said something to the effect that my uncle was Ernie in the first movie. And he said, "I remember him." So it was fun. It really was fun.
Say it once, say it twice, third time's a charm. For Vermont Public, I'm Daniela Fierro.
And you can see photos of the 80s movie set and watch a short film of Daniela's visit by going to vermontpublic.org. And ahead of today's show, we got an email from a listener named Nicole, who is a still photographer for the sequel. Nicole writes, "I don't know which made me prouder, finally working on a movie in Vermont or working with the incredible Tim Burton on Beetlejuice in East Corinth last year. After the tumultuous drive from Manchester to East Corinth during the rain and the floods the day prior before principal photography started, I was very happy to be on set. And thank you to the people of East Corinth, especially the convenience store and the ice cream shop." Nicole, thanks so much for writing in. From a small town plagued by vampires to a haunted weeping statue in the state capitol, our region is full of spooky spots. Our ghoulish guide for the rest of this hour is Amanda Gustin. She's the Director of Collections and Access at the Vermont Historical Society, and she has some stories to share. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Amanda, first, I recently heard that you are a descendant of someone involved in the Salem witch trials. Is that right?
It is, yeah. I have one of those like umpteen generation New England families, and I'm a direct descendant of Susanna Martin, who was one of the women accused and then hanged as part of the Salem witch trials.
Wow. How did you find this out?
Oh, it comes with that umpteen generations of New England. People have written many, many family genealogies. And as you might expect from someone who ended up choosing to work in history museums. I was a very dorky small child, and I read them all. And I also grew up not too far from Salem, Massachusetts, so we would visit occasionally.
Okay. And is there information about your ancestor in some of the Salem witch buildings and museums that are there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
What's it feel like to read those materials or kind of plumb that relationship?
It's sort of a weird mix of sadness and pride, I guess.
Yeah.
Sadness because it was of course a horrible event that took the lives of innocent people and ruined many, many other lives. And it's sort of eerie, to reflect that was a family member of yours experiencing that, right. But also a certain degree of pride because I've read her trial transcripts and she basically is up there, in the witness stand saying this whole thing is made up. What are you doing? Let me go home. Really kind of sticking it to them, which unfortunately did not end well for her. But knowing, that I had family is at an important point in history is, yeah, it's a point of pride.
Yeah, that's a really remarkable history to have. And as you mentioned, being a dorky kid who loved reading about these histories was a great training for the career that you now have working in collections at the Vermont Historical Society. You've been working in museums for many years now, right?
Yeah, I started working in libraries when I was 14, and I got my first museum job when I was 18. It was a summer job in college, and then continued on to work in either research libraries or museums and do graduate work in history right on through. And I'm very fortunate to have been with the Vermont Historical Society for a little over 10 years now.
Mm. Well, today we are asking listeners to share some of their spookiest stories with us, particularly if there's a place in our region that has this kind of unique spooky history that we're talking about today for Halloween. Give us a call at 800-639-2211. We have Dina in Corinth on the line. Go ahead.
When we bought our house here, 40 years ago, I was told there was a ghost here, and I thought, surely I'm the kind of person who can see a ghost, and I never did. And one time we went away, and someone stayed in our house, and we didn't tell anything about a ghost. And when we came back, this woman told me, I saw a ghost here. And I said, you did? She said, yes. I said, where was it? She said, well, he was walking up and down the stairs. So someone saw the ghost. I hadn't told her there was one. So that's my story.
Wait, okay, but I have to know, what makes you say that you are the kind of person that would see a ghost?
No, I said I hoped I was
the kind of person
would be able to see a ghost, you know. You wish you're that kind of person, and I never did see the ghost.
Well, thank you for calling and sharing that with us. I don't know if I wish to be the kind of person that sees a ghost. I hope they just pass me by if they're here. Thanks so much, Dina, for calling. Amanda, we just started with the witch trials of Salem, the famous ones. I'm curious if there were any witch trials here in Vermont or in this northern New England region.
Yeah, there's one known witch trial in Vermont. It was actually in Pownal. And I should say a lot of the research around this was done by Joyce Held with the Pownal Historical Society, who's done just really phenomenal work uncovering this story and spelling it out a little bit more, which I think speaks to the strength of the local historical societies across the state of Vermont. So this is a woman named Marguerite Krieger, often colloquially known as the Widow Krieger. Her husband passed away in 1785, leaving her a relatively well-off widow. So she fits some of those same characteristics that some of the women accused in Salem did, right? She was apparently a strong personality, had some wealth to her name. And that same year that her husband died, she was accused of witchcraft and put on trial. And one of the ways that they supposedly determined whether a person was a witch or not was by dunking. And this is actually not unheard of in witch trials. You see this across England and in other areas, which is that if you drop or dunk the person accused into a pot of water, in this case, it was the Hoosick River in Pownal, if they float, then they are a witch. If they sink, then they are innocent. Of course, then you have to get them out of the river. So sometimes women who were accused of and then, I guess, absolved of witchcraft by sinking, still did die. Luckily, that was not the case for Marguerite Krieger. She was rescued and pulled out of the Hoosic River, and she lived a number of years after that as a proven to be innocent.
Oh, wow.
By
so
that
she was
trial.
Absolved. It has something of a happy ending.
Yes. Yes.
We'll take what we can get.
Yeah, still not a thing anyone should have to go through.
No, certainly
yes.
not. So that is the one known witch trial that was in Vermont. No others.
Yes. So, yep, that's the only one we know of. Yep.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Peter in Troy calling in. Peter, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? No, I just wanted to touch base. I thought this was kind of interesting. My ninth great-grandmother was hung as a witch in Salem, Suzanne Baker, or the Baker. And on my dad's side, I'm a direct descendant of Cotton Mather.
Tell us about Cotton Mather.
Cotton Mather was the priest or minister that was in charge of deciding who got hung.
Wow, what a family lineage. Do you remember how you first found this out, Peter?
Yeah, through the my sister did the DNA thing, and that's when that first came out. But I've always known about Cotton Mather because we used to visit the Mathers, which were cut down on my dad's side.
Wow.
So we've always known that.
Mm. Well, Peter, thank you so
much. I've always just thought it was interesting about the conflict.
Yeah, seriously. Does that manifest in your life at all?
Well, you know, you got to wonder, right? Some people say cells have memory. So when you have internal conflict,
yeah.
You know, but no, not really, I don't think.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for calling in. That's kind of amazing. Amanda, another person with connection to the Salem witch trials.
I think if you go far back enough in American history, it's not uncommon for quite a lot of us to share a singular ancestor. I also have ancestors who came over on the Mayflower, and there are tens of thousands of Mayflower descendants out there as well. But it's always interesting when you can trace back. For me, genealogy is the most interesting when it can give you that emotional or that personal connection to significant events. And it sounds like Peter has sort of that dichotomy of that moment in history right there in his own history.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Peter, for sharing that story with us. We have another Peter calling in now from Brattleboro. Go ahead.
Hi. So this is Peter from Brattleboro. There is a graveyard here in Brattleboro. I believe it's towards the end of, or it's somewhere near Orchard Street. I don't know if I have the name of the street correctly. And I'm sure if there are other listeners in Brattleboro, somebody else will call in to confirm this. There is a grave stone, which it's written on the gravestone, Frankenstein. And I believe it's a woman's name, like Elvira or something. I don't know.
Mm. Interesting. Do you know anything about who this person was?
I have no idea.
All right. Well, other Brattleborians, call in 800-639-2211. We got to get to the bottom of this Frankenstein gravestone there in Brattleboro. Peter, any other spooky places that you want to tell us about?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. Not really, no.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can figure out more about this gravestone for you. Have you heard of this cemetery that Peter's talking about, Amanda?
No, that's a new one on me. I kind of want to go visit now.
Amanda, we were just talking about witch trials. I also hear that there was a vampire scare in New England at one point. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think this one is really interesting because I think we currently in this moment have a very specific pop culture conception of a vampire, and this is not really that. They were certainly using the words vampires and vampirism, but what they were worried about was a sort of a wasting or a sapping of energy. So it fits in with the idea of a vampire there. So to be more thorough on it, there were a number of people across New England. Well, there were many people across New England who were dying of tuberculosis at the time, which they would have called consumption. And we have a couple of specific examples in Vermont of people who died of consumption. One name is Frederick Ransom, who died in 1817. He was 20 years old. He was a student at Dartmouth College. And now we understand tuberculosis to be a treatable disease with antibiotics. Then they did not have germ theory, so they did not truly understand how people were getting tuberculosis, and it was effectively untreatable. So people would waste away slowly and frankly painfully, sometimes for many years before they died. And then potentially other people around them might begin to show those same symptoms of that slow wasting. It was often called a wasting disease. So Frederick died of tuberculosis, and then others of his family member began showing similar symptoms. And absent a scientific answer, what we now know today, at the time, they began to speculate that the family members were subject to the same kind of vampirism that had perhaps affected Frederick, or maybe he had now become a vampire. It's a little unclear in the records. And so they exhumed his body, and they removed his heart from his body and burned that heart as what they believed to be a cure. Unfortunately, it was not a cure. Several other members of his family did die of tuberculosis. So it was an attempt to stop the unknowable, right? It's a lot of scary stories point us toward things that we don't understand, we can't control. And for people at that time, tuberculosis was understandably an absolutely terrifying disease. And so we see this, a very similar scenario repeated in other places in New England. We see it repeated at least once or twice more in Vermont. Randomly, the two most well-known cases are both in Woodstock.
Oh, can you tell us about those?
Coincidence. Yeah, well, the first one was Frederick Ransom. Oh, sure, this, sure. This was in Woodstock. The second one was a little bit later in the 1830s, a man named Corwin. And this is an interesting one because this sort of points to us the sometimes apocryphal nature of these stories, the sort of quasi-history verging into folklore stories. This is a man named Corwin who supposedly died in 1830, and it's the same pattern, right? He died of tuberculosis, and then other members of his family began showing symptoms. And so they, again, exhumed his body and burned the heart. Some versions of the story have this becoming a very, very elaborate public event, and then reburying those ashes underneath a granite monument. And this was recounted by a woman who was supposedly, as a young woman or a small child, present at the time. She recounted it something like 50 years later. But when we go back and do the research of the town records, we don't find any other corroboration of this. So was she understanding other similar stories and sort of conflating them with something else she had seen at a child? Is this how these folklore stories get repeated? We don't know, but it points to that same fear of the unknown, fear of this really terrifying disease that it felt like could happen to anyone.
Mm. Oh, if only we could go back and ask. I want to go back to our phone lines because I think we have an answer to our question about that Frankenstein grave in Brattleboro. Stuart is on the line. Stuart, go ahead. What do you know?
Yeah, there is a small graveyard on the grounds, not actually the main campus, but there's a building that's part of the Brattleboro retreat called Linden Lodge. And in between Linden Lodge and the retreat tower, there was a small graveyard there that I think was used for long-term patients of the retreat who died at the retreat. And there was a grave there of a woman named Anna Frankenstein. That gravestone may have been removed because it was sort of a gathering for teenagers at various points in the 70s and 80s. But that was... I've seen the gravestone, and that's where it was. I don't know if it's still there or not.
Stuart, I don't want to presume your age here, but were you one of those teenagers?
No. I was past my teens in the 70s and 80s.
Okay, but you heard about it.
Heard about it and used to hike up that trail from Linden Lodge up to the retreat towers.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Stuart, any other spooky spots in Brattleboro or the area that you want to tell us about?
No. No. All right. That,
Well, thanks so much for calling in. Good to get an answer. Let's go to Kevin in Burlington next. Kevin, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, is this, are you talking to me?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I'm Kevin from Brattleboro.
Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
I live on Orchard Street. I was just calling to confirm that that is the graveyard up there. Because the person who called in wasn't entirely certain. I was just calling to say I just moved to Orchard Street last year, and that is the graveyard he is talking about.
Okay. Do you go there often? Good place for walks?
I haven't, but now I have a good reason to.
All right. Well, tell us what you hear once you go. Thanks so much for calling in, Kevin. Amanda Gustin with the Vermont Historical Society. Let's stick to the grave and graveyard theme here. You have a story to tell us about Timothy Clark Smith in New Haven. Who was he?
Sure. We actually don't know much about him personally. What he is most famous for is his gravesite. And Timothy was part of a very, very Victorian obsession, which was the fear that when you were pronounced dead, you might not actually be dead. Mm. This was a very common, a lot of people, this is pre sort of modern medicine and pre true understandings of a lot of things. And there were these very elaborate ways in which people sought to ensure that if by chance they were not actually dead, they were in a deep coma or something else like that, when they were buried, they would have a means to get out of their graves. And some of these, again, get quite elaborate. There are bell systems and people paid to wait by the graves and so on and so forth. And so Timothy Clark Smith was buried in the cemetery in New Haven, and his grave includes a small window and a sort of a concrete block and then a window in the top of it that I guess in theory you could have looked down and seen that he was not in fact dead. As I understand it, for most and perhaps shortly after he was buried, it became so full of condensation that you can't see anything in it at all, but you can absolutely still see that there is a block with a window in it.
Oh, wow. So ostensibly you could have seen the body as it decomposed, but it's too fogged up now to ever do that.
Yeah, I guess in theory, I think it probably fogged up pretty quickly. I don't know that it was ever an effective solution.
I guess he could have knocked in there. Have you heard of other graves like this one?
So it's my understanding that there are other graves like this one. If not windows, then definitely other contraptions to alert people that the person in the grave was in fact not dead. I do not know of any in Vermont.
Mm. I guess that's why I'll be buried with my cell phone. Let's go next to Frederick in Brattleboro, who has a story to share with us. Frederick, go ahead.
Hey there. I've been fascinated by this building every time I've driven by in Old Bennington. It's called the Wollumsack Inn. It's supposed to be the oldest hotel in the state, going back to Revolutionary War times. And a bunch of notable meetings and things happened during those years, and it's rumored that both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison stopped by there on their way through town in 1791 when they were touring Vermont, and Robert Frost, Walt Disney, and Rutherford B. Hayes stayed there as well. But the building is really decrepit and spooky looking, especially when you drive by at night. There's all these windows with shutters and old curtains, and none of the lights were ever on. And I think there was a family member who was living in just one of the bottom floor spaces. So you might see one or two lights on. And then I guess when they passed away, they had been told by their father not to change anything with the hotel. And they took him so literally that they didn't actually maintain it. So that's part of why it got so decrepit. Apparently there's an effort now to revitalize it since it's such a historic space.
Wow. Well, I've seen photos of the Wollumsack, and it is an amazing building. It's just inviting somebody to make a horror film there. Frederick, thanks so much for calling in and telling us about it. I know. Amanda, do you know anything about this building?
A little bit. It's probably not the oldest inn in Vermont. It dates to 1771, but it certainly has, it's a prominent building in the area, and it certainly has a storied history over the years. Bennington has their share of old stories and spooky spots. They talk about the idea of them being the first town in Vermont, the first settled town in Vermont. So it's certainly a place steeped in history and beautiful old buildings like that.
Mm. Well, I just learned an interesting fact about it by a quick Google on obscure Vermont. Apparently, it is still standing because underneath all those sagging wood, it's made of brick underneath. So that's why it's still able to stay up. Well, thanks, Frederick, for calling and telling us about it. Michael in South Burlington is on the line, too. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My story is that back when I went to University of Vermont, I lived in Converse Hall, which was supposedly haunted by a ghost named Henry.
Mm.
And the story was that he was a medical student who committed suicide in the attic. And Converse Hall is pretty distinctive. It's an old Gothic building right by the medical center. And there was an attic there, and you would hear stories about people hearing odd things when they were up there studying at night.
Ooh, did you ever hear anything?
I never heard anything, and actually I believe there was a story in the Cynic when I was there that kind of investigated it and kind of debunked the whole backstory, which was unfortunate because it's a really cool old building. It would have been nice to have a resident ghost.
Wow. Well, thanks for telling us about it. Last year on Halloween, we had a real-life Ghostbuster from Vermont on the show, so maybe we can call her up and see if she's investigated it or anyone else in her group. Amanda, just before the break, we had a caller bring up a UVM building, and that reminded me of a story that I heard about grave digging and how it used to be a common practice at Castleton's Medical School. Have you heard about this?
Yes, and I would say not just Castleton. This is a sort of well-known phenomenon related to a lot of medical schools because medical students needed and still need cadavers in order to completely understand human anatomy. And Castleton Medical School, one of the earliest medical schools in the state, they, at the time, they were welcoming students. It was not easy to get cadaver bodies. Donating your body to science wasn't really a thing yet. They could occasionally get the bodies of people executed for crimes, but that wasn't actually happening all that much in Vermont. And so it was not unknown for either students themselves or other people to engage in some grave robbing in order to get bodies to study and dissect. And this leads to a particularly famous incident in 1830 that becomes known as the Hubbardton Raid, in which a group of citizens in Hubbardton noticed that the grave of a woman who had recently died was disturbed. And they concluded that it was the students at Castleton. They descended upon the students at Castleton and were able to locate the body of the woman hidden on the Castleton campus, unfortunately for all concerned. And it was actually commemorated in poems and pamphlets as many as 50 years afterward, that very specific incident. But again, this was, again, not an uncommon practice. There were actually people who made good money and a living exhuming bodies to support medical schools.
Oh, wow. Well, okay, you just brought up poems, and that reminds me of Frozen Charlotte, which is one of the most famous poems on our theme today. I actually first learned about this, I think, from one of your colleagues, Amanda, at the Vermont Historical Society. There's a doll of Frozen Charlotte in your doll collections there, which are also very spooky. And mm-hmm. this poem and song was a favorite in Vermont. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, Frozen Charlotte's actually kind of a favorite of mine, because what I was saying earlier, that a lot of these stories that we tell get at big unknowns, or they underscore morals. I think this is a really good example of that. So Frozen Charlotte began as probably, and this is all a little murky, right? But probably began as a poem written by someone in Maine named Sebas Smith. But then it became most famous when it was set to music here in Vermont by a man named William Lorenzo Carter, who was from Benson, Vermont. He was born blind, but it was apparently something of a musical prodigy and frequently came up with melodies, either writing his own lyrics to them or setting other people's writings to melodies. And so there is a version of a ballad, the most common version of the ballad, Frozen Charlotte, with music written here in Vermont. And the story of Frozen Charlotte is that she is a young woman who was departing her home along with her boyfriend to go to a ball. And she was wearing, most accounts have it as a silk dress, a very fancy dress regardless. And on her way out the door, her mother was saying to her, you should bundle up, you should put on a coat, you should put on something that's a little warmer because it's winter. And the ballad sort of tells the story of her mother setting the warnings and then of this young woman going to the ball and her boyfriend. And unfortunately, different versions are either on the way or on the way home. She does, in fact, freeze to death. She arrives back at her home completely frozen solid from this carriage, sleigh ride. And I find this one, this has got so many layers to it, so many levels to it. There's the like, do what your parents tell you. I think we all have been told by our parents to put on a jacket when leaving the house. And that is universal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's reminding people who are listening to the ballad that you should listen to your parents and put on a jacket when you're leaving the house. It also has this other layer of this young woman who is more concerned with fashion and more concerned with looking good than with practicality. And so she gets, you know, in the context of this ballad, her just rewards of freezing to death for being too shallow or what have you. And then the third layer, which is something I think is actually really crucial for Vermont specifically, is winter and the weather as an antagonist. And this is something today we get excited when it starts to snow. We're looking forward to ski season. We have a lot of ways of coping with the snow and of enjoying the snow. And for most of Vermont's history, that was very much not the case. Winter was a time of dire and extreme danger for people living here in Vermont. And so that's that third layer to that song, that it was absolutely possible and even likely for you to freeze to death if you left the house without the appropriate clothing. So there's a lot going on there. There are recordings of this ballad going back many, many, many decades. There's a couple of them held at the Helen Harness Flanders Ballad Collection at Middlebury College. That's how actually I became first familiar with this specific story, was looking at the sheet music and listening to the music when I was a student there. So I just think this one really encapsulates a lot.
Okay, so to all my ladies at UVM walking down to Red Square at 11 at night, I see you. I was one of you once, but oh my goodness, put on a coat. You are freezing. We have a clip from a Frozen Charlotte recording. Let's listen to that now.
This was recorded July 21, 1946.
They reached the inn and Charles sprang out. And giving his hand to her, why sit you like a monument, what has no power to stir? He called her once, he called her twice, but yet she never stirred. He called her name again and again, but the answer not a word. He took her hand in his, oh God, it was cold and hard as stone.
So spooky. I love that recording with the crackling.
It's beautiful.
Let's get in a couple more calls from listeners. We will go first to Eric in Montreal. Eric, go ahead. Hey, Eric, are you with us?
Hello. I'm with you. You hear me?
Yes. What's the story you have to share?
Right. Well, it's more of a, we spent with my wife and my 9-year-old daughter, we went to Salem last weekend. We're from Montreal and, you know, they were kind of into it. And I said, you know what, pack up your brooms and let's go on a road trip. And it was really beautiful. And we really, really, really enjoyed it. It was a lot of people, but it was well organized. It was clean. It was a nice restaurant, and there was a very interesting history about the trials and the witches, and it was just a fabulous trip, and I suggest it to any families.
Oh, that's great. I bet it was a very busy time of year there, too. Eric, is there one highlight from being in Salem that you want to share?
Well, I kind of was a bit particular to see the Hocus Pocus house where it was filmed, I guess. But even where the trials were, like, it was just very historical, and it wasn't, like, made up, like, going to Disneyland. It was, like, a real town with real history.
Mm.
Very interesting.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for calling in. I'm really glad you enjoyed that trip. Let's go next to Fred, who I think is in central Vermont. Fred, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Years ago, we babysat for a neighbor's house, and it was inhabited by three souls, I'd like to call them, because they weren't really dangerous or anything. But I think the best story was there was one room in the house that had belonged to a little girl. It was her bedroom at one time, and she had died of some, I forget what causes, it might have been pneumonia. And that room was always sad until the next owners had bought it. They put games in that room, and the room actually became happy, and they noticed that the games would shift at times, like somebody was looking through them, but they spent very little time in this room. And the best time this room was at Christmas time when we set up a Christmas tree and it was all done for Christmas. This room, you could actually feel that it was happy. But there was actually one gentleman who passed away during a wood chopping accident, and would show up occasionally. He would be sitting in his favorite chair. But what I found with all the people who've had encounters in Vermont is most of the people are more inquisitive that hang about, and they're like, they seem to be wondering why you're in their place.
That sounds like a true Vermont ghost to me. Fred, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. Amanda, we have just a couple of minutes left, but there's one spooky story out of Vermont that I really don't want us to miss, and that is the story of Phineas Gage. Could you tell us about him?
Yeah, so Phineas Gage was a railroad worker in Vermont, and he was struck by a piece of metal that came off the railroad, a construction accident. And that, it's sometimes called a tamping iron, big, long piece of metal. Don't think small, think like really big. It struck him and actually went completely through his head. It destroyed a significant portion of his brain, and he lived through it. If you Google it, you can see, I won't describe it well, but you can see sort of where this rod went through his head. He lived through it. It was removed, and he lived through for a number of years after that, not too long, but a number of years after that. And this is a really interesting case because it actually is sort of important in the history of neurology and neuroscience because people were able to document that his personality changed. And this is how some of their earliest understandings about that damage to the specific parts of your brain might exhibit behavioral changes. And this was an early piece of evidence for that.
Wow. That is fascinating. And yeah, this is definitely a must Google. The photos are pretty incredible, the images. Amanda, you have access to these amazing collections at the Vermont Historical Society. If somebody wants to maybe see some of these collections, particularly for Halloween, some of your spookier ones, I'm thinking of those dolls that I saw a couple years ago. Can they do that? How would they go about accessing them?
Yeah, so as the State Historical Society, we have two locations, the museum in Montpelier, which is in the Pavilion Building, it's just to the next to the State House. And you can visit the museum Tuesday through Saturday at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's a sort of curated exhibition that tells the whole history of Vermont, which there's a lot of various things, probably some of them spooky, depending on your definition of spooky. And we also recently opened a new exhibit gallery at the Vermont History Center in Barrie. And the Vermont History Center is our administrative and research building. This is where we keep all of our collections. This is where our collection staff works out of, where our research library is. So you can come visit the research library when that is open. That's Tuesday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we also, at the same those same hours, you can visit the newly opened Research and Exhibition Gallery, which we're really excited and really proud of. And that gives us the ability to bring out literally thousands of objects that are normally kept in storage. And we've designed that so that you do the exploring. You can scan QR codes and read the complete object record and learn more and think about the ways that you make connections between the objects instead of us necessarily placing them in part of a narrative for you. And then the final layer of this is, if you have a really hyper-specific interest, whether a research interest or just a strong personal interest,
the dolls,
we're always happy to schedule research appointments for folks and bring items out of our collection storage for more one-on-one time. That is part of our mission. That's why our department is Collections and Access, is to make sure that people know that these are held in trust for the people of Vermont, and our mission is to connect people to Vermont's story. So we love doing that.
Well, Amanda, I'm so appreciative of you taking the time to connect us to some of Vermont's spookier stories today in honor of Halloween. Amanda Gustin is with the Vermont Historical Society. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy Halloween.